equal time. Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettmeyer, your Monday host for Equal Time Radio. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. We've got a great show coming up for you today. What would happen if we legalized drugs and then taxed and regulated them? We'll also look at the bill working its way through the legislature to release a lot of nonviolent offenders as of July 1st of this year. Our guests are Tom Powell, who for 18 years was clinical director at the Department of Corrections, and Tom Lozen, mayor of Barrie, with a couple of Toms in here. We'll be using full names, I believe, to talk to people just to keep things straight for the listeners. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, Carl, how is drug law, how's corrections, incarceration, how is all that related to the theme of energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil? Well, here's how I think about it. First of all, some news that has gotten virtually no coverage in U.S. press. The U.S. has now officially acknowledged that the world is likely entering the downside of the oil production curve. You know, oil production is like a bell curve in various regions of the world where you have oil. And if I were standing in front of you, I'd make gestures with my hands. But basically, it goes up and then it comes back down. The U.S. peaked in its oil production in 1970 and had been going down more or less steadily ever since. A little bit of blips when the Alaska oil came online, for example. But a top Energy Department official told the French newspaper Le Monde 2 weeks ago that he expects world oil production to decline starting next year and through 2015 if the investment in new production capacity isn't there. And we pretty much know now that it's not there. New projects take at least 5 years to bring online. And over the last 18 months, the record has been a lot of cancellations and delays of projects. So if this Energy Department official, his name is Glenn Sweetnam, if he's right, and there are a lot of geologists and oil market experts out there who agree with him, then we're about to experience a cutback in the amount of energy we use. And that's going to have profound effects on the economy. The economy's built around cheap energy and on abundant energy. There's a pretty strong correlation over the last 5 decades between economic growth and energy growth. Now, there is a lot of room for efficiency and conservation and renewables to pick up the slack, but as James Howard Kunstler, who's been a guest in this show, as he says, there's no way to run Walmart, Disney World, and the interstate highway system on any combinations of renewables and efficiency. So, in my opinion, we're looking at, in the medium term, for the next decade or so, an economy that will experience various cycles of what we've seen over the last 5 years. A run-up in oil prices as economic growth picks up, which we're seeing already right now. Oil prices get too high for many sectors of the economy, and therefore growth stalls again. Oil prices drop down, but not as low as they were in the previous trough. So this fiscal crisis that states find themselves in right now, I don't see it as a temporary blip. I expect revenues to be short and needs high for the foreseeable future. So when we're spending 10% of the Vermont General Funds on corrections and locking people up who could be doing valuable work in the community, I wonder how well that money is being spent. And that's a very broad topic. Today I want to focus primarily on drug law and its effects, although, as I said, we will be talking about this bill in the legislature, S-292, and its proposal to release a fair number of nonviolent offenders later on this year. Drug law is an area where some parts of the law just don't make sense of me, regardless of whether we can afford to put people in jail for using drugs. You know, in Dubai, we've learned you can be imprisoned for kissing in public. The court there just upheld a month-long sentence for a couple who's caught kissing in a restaurant. Here in the U.S., we imprison people who grow a plant that the government doesn't like, marijuana, or who have some of the dried leaves or buds from that same plant. This is an issue that I think transcends right or left. You've got law enforcement against prohibition, a nationwide organization of mostly retired law enforcement officers, because they don't think it's good for their career, I guess, to talk about this while they're still working in law enforcement, who speak out for ending prohibition on all drugs. And then there's Will Wilkinson of the Libertarian Cato Institute. He wrote almost exactly a year ago, quote, "The Atlantic Monthly's Andrew Sullivan has been documenting on his blog the stories of typical productive Americans, kids football coaches, secretaries of the PTA, who smoke marijuana because they like to smoke marijuana, but who understandably fear emerging fully from the cannabis closet. This is a profoundly necessary idea. If we're to begin to roll back our stupid and deadly drug war, The stigma of responsible drug use has got to end, and marijuana is the best place to start. The super savvy Barack Obama managed to turn a buck by coming out of the cannabis and cocaine closet in a best-selling memoir. That's progress. But his admission came with a politician's caveat of regret. We'll make real progress when solid, upstanding folk come out of the cannabis closet, heads held high. So here we go. My name is Will Wilkinson. I smoke marijuana, and I like it. Well, my name is Carl Ettenayer. I have smoked marijuana. I haven't for years, but I do like it, and would like to see possibility of doing so again without fear of legal retribution. So with that as an introduction, then let's go to our wonderful guests today. The first one we'll be talking with is, and they're both here in the studio, is Tom Powell. He has a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Vermont. For 18 years, he was director of clinical programs at the Department of Corrections. That was from 86 until 2004. And now he works as a clinical and forensic psychologist in Shelburne. So, Tom Powell, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And why don't you tell us about give us a little bit of history of the last couple decades, what we've seen in terms of incarceration here in Vermont, how that relates to population growth and to the crime rate.
Well, the population of Vermont corrections has just about tripled since I began working actually as a correctional officer back in 1977. Before I moved into administration, I was on the front lines as a probation officer, as a caseworker, and I started out as a correctional officer. Went back to school later and found new ways of being involved in the system. But during that time, Vermont's overall population has remained pretty much unchanged. So we've seen, effectively, a rate of incarceration in Vermont probably just about triple over the last 30 years or so. The question, of course, is, has the crime rate gone up at such a rate as to justify that kind of expenditure of money out of the state revenues, as well as the loss of human capital on the streets in the form of people who would otherwise be working and involved with their families and their communities? And I think the statistics would indicate, no, they've not, nowhere near. In fact, I think much of what corrections has had to deal with over the last 20 years in particular has been response to the outlier cases that occur with some regularity. For instance, Vermont has about 12 murders a year. That number has not changed a whole lot over the years I've been watching it. And yet, some of those cases have been horrific. They've captured media and public attention and led to responses in the legislature, which have been substantial. The upping of sentences, restrictions on judges' discretion, and importantly, the appointment of a parole board that is very reluctant to turn people loose. So you've got this system, which I use the analogy of a hydraulic system, where you've got increasing pressure at one end of the hose with the valve firmly turned off at the other. And what happens in the middle is it swells and swells and swells. And we've now got, this enormous number of inmates. The rate of incarceration and supervision in Vermont is one of the leading ones in the country, which comes as a bit of a surprise in a state which generally has about the bottom one or two in terms of crime rate. So I think there's an imbalance here which is largely driven by outlier cases, overreaction by the legislature, and an inability by the Department of Corrections to have the elbow room it needs and the resources it needs to act in a lateral fashion to move people into, say, halfway houses and other settings where they'd have a more appropriate level of care.
And what role do drug crimes play and drug-related crimes play in this increasing incarceration?
Well, drugs have played a substantial role in a relapse of people's behavior back into crime. There's two ways of looking at drugs. One is the actual possession of them and the laws that associate with possession, sale, and transport. Some of those are handled in the federal judiciary. Many of them are handled in state, and they've contributed greatly to increases in population. The second way that drugs apply are through the commission of crimes, the disinhibiting effects, the sedating effects, the lack of good sense that prevails on people who are using regularly. As well, we've seen a change in the magnitude of the effect that certain drugs have. Heroin and crack cocaine are a lot more powerful than marijuana, and they lead to another response set. The addictive properties are different. You see the principles of reinforcement. As a psychologist, I'm talking now as to what causes addiction and what supports addiction. And there are certain well-established behavioral principles that underlie addiction. And with crack cocaine and methamphetamine, that's a lot different than marijuana. And people will do a lot more desperate things to continue to be able to use and score than they will if they're just run out of pot. Mm-hmm. So you see people committing crimes as a result of this. And the good news, of course, is that there are some treatment programs in Vermont, particularly the buprenorphine program, as it's run by Howard Mental Health or Howard Services and the University of Vermont, which clinically has had some terrific benefits in terms of reduction of crime days for people who are opiate addicts. There are problems with buprenorphine. It gets into the wrong hands. It gets misused like other drugs. But
buprenorphine is known more commonly as methadone. Is that correct?
Methadone is a different drug.
It's a different drug.
But it also is effective at reducing crime days. Okay. So whether you like the idea of replacing one addiction with another, I kind of like the idea of reducing crime days. And that's what happens when you use those two medications.
Now, why is it that people under those medications are not committing so many crimes? Is it part of it because they don't have the costs associated with going out on the black market to buy drugs that are costly and illegal?
Right, they don't need to. Their addictions are satiated and lessened to some extent by the methadone and the buprenorphine. The receptor areas of the brain, which are the core of the addictive process, are satiated and lessened by use of those meds, in some cases blocked. There's other medications that actually block the receptor sites. Mm. So these things are all helpful in terms of lessening a person's craving, and therefore they're turning to crime to satisfy the craving.
Mm. And you also mentioned that drug-related crime, there's a disinhibiting effect of the drugs that make people more likely to commit criminal acts. Do you see more of that disinhibition from the heroin than you would from buprenorphine or methadone?
Oh, I don't know if we can make too many distinctions there. Actually, cocaine is much more of a disinhibiting drug in terms of its effects than heroin is. Heroin's is not a central nervous stimulant like cocaine is. And when you are out of cocaine, you will do just about anything to get more. And that's when people really get crazy. There are, of course, opiate addicts, heroin addicts, who will pursue it at great length. But, you know, many who don't. Many have a lesser level of addiction, just like marijuana and other sort of lesser drugs. The drug we haven't seen a lot of in Vermont, although law enforcement tells us it's coming, is methamphetamine, speed, which is cheap, easy to make, and very, very deadly and toxic. It's an awful drug. And I hope it stays the way it has. I'm not sure it will. Law enforcement has raised some red flags about its entrance into Vermont.
Hmm. So in California, there's a ballot measure that's qualified to be on the ballot to control and tax marijuana, cannabis. And there is a press release issued last week from an organization which supports the measure. The press release says, the news was hailed by a number of veteran law enforcement officials across California. And this is a quote from retired Superior Court Judge James P. Gray. As a retired judge, I've been on the front lines of the drug war for 3 decades, and I know from experience that the current approach is simply not working. Controlling marijuana with regulations similar to those currently in place will put street drug dealers and organized crime out of business. And also, unquote. And also, the taxes from the legal sale of marijuana are being looked at as a way to help plug the gaping hole in California's budget. Your comments, Tom Powell.
Well, in the northern reaches of California, the growth of marijuana is considered to be the number one industry. Mm-hmm. And everybody in the straight as well as not straight social groups up there are concerned about the passage of this law because it's going to take away all the money that's flowing into those counties right now. Eureka, Arcata, up in that neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm.
I think that because there's such a it's such a literally growth industry up there. Mm-hmm. You know, you probably see a different set of incentives to keep it alive as is. But I think that what you're going to see across the country is a lot of law enforcement saying, gee, we spend an awful lot of our limited resources running down drugs that just don't matter that much. You don't have to like marijuana in order to think twice about the wisdom of making it illegal and having jail terms associated with its possession. And for the last 15, 20 years, people have been increasingly talking about the wisdom of saying, look, it didn't work. Nancy Reagan was wrong. And just saying no is not an effective deterrent to any kind of drug. And the marijuana scare is just that. It's a scare. It's probably not associated as a gateway drug for most people. There are those who should not use it because they're vulnerable to all kinds of disinhibiting behaviors. There's a sector of the population that are always going to get in trouble, whether they drink, whether they smoke pot, or whether they take up any kind of other activity that's addictive. Most people will do as most of us have, which is to try it out when we're young, realize that it's not a great idea to continue as we get older, and self-correct. I went to college in the 60s and 70s, and if you didn't at least try pot back then, there was something very strange about you. Yeah. So I would say that it hardly had a long-term killer effect on my peer group.
We're talking with Tom Powell. He's a former director of clinical programs at the Department of Correction. The topic is drug law. The broader topic is also, why do we incarcerate people? What other alternatives are there to that? And we have very patiently sitting here in the studio also Tom Lozen. He's the mayor of Barrie. He's works as a CPA at Salvador and Babick. He develops real estate, and he's the scourge of pie throwers everywhere. And Tom Lozen, I want to give you plenty of time to respond to what Tom Powell said and talk about the situation in Barrie. Do we have two callers on the line? Just one caller. We do have here from Waterbury, Tom, another Tom. So let's bring him on the line and give him a chance. He's maybe responding to something Tom Powell just said. Hello, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, I did want to respond to that. I just wanted to ask Mr. Paula knows what kind of programs that the Department of Corrections offers for addiction currently, because he was the former head of that. Is that what you said?
Director of Clinical Programs, yes.
Okay, so what clinical programs do they have currently? And I'd like to respond to him if he could tell me that.
Okay.
It's been 5 years since I was actually in the administrative role where I could answer that precisely. But it is the case that the department still has what's called ISAP programs, the Intensive Substance Abuse Program, which is run as an intermediate sanction program out of the department's probation and parole offices. That's the primary intervention. Federal and state cutbacks have, I believe, resulted in the termination of a therapeutic community program that was based in the Newport prison, where people with severe addictions were able to spend any number of months, sometimes years, in a custodial setting in residential treatment program. There's also a fair amount of local groups, particularly the AA/NA communities, that are very active with offender groups, although
AA is Alcoholics Anonymous?
Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous,
okay.
NA.
So my real
which
question
I think
is,
are,
and I agree with you with all of the,
everything just a minute.
You said.
He's asking a question again. Go ahead, Tom.
I agree with everything you just said. My point was going to be, why is it at this point that we only offer the 12-step program and spirituality as an alternative to what we see as the problem of addiction? Maybe you can address that. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Tom.
Well, I think the ISAP programs go beyond that. They do look at psychosocial and other factors in a person's life that contribute to their repeated use of drugs and alcohol. It's a very intensive program, meeting regularly two or three times a week. It's mandatory attendance, and there's a whole lot of structure that goes with it, from the state's probation officers involving surveillance of their objective findings with, you know, your analysis, with constantly checking up on them and making sure that they're doing what they're supposed to do. It's a very intensive program. Those people who go through it, I think they have a pretty good success rate of staying sober during it, and afterwards they need a step-down program. I think I would agree with the caller that there may be a link missing there in that chain, where you go from very very strong and very intensive program down to essentially a self-supporting system and membership in recovery groups. There is a set of recovery houses that are not spiritually affiliated, which are springing up around Vermont. They are independently, I think, self-sustaining. And that's very positive. But, you know, I think what Vermont is missing is sober housing, is the kinds of support for alternative lifestyles, which these folks sometimes really need desperately. And the trouble is, I think this is the problem that I've got with the system right now, is that, and it may be the caller's point, is that it's one or the other. It's one extreme or the other you're going to.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom Powell. Now we're going to go to Tom Lozen, Mayor of Barrie, and we've heard quite a bit from our other guest, Tom Powell, on drugs and incarceration. And 2 weeks ago, you welcomed Senator Patrick Leahy and the Senate Judiciary Committee to your city to hold a hearing on drugs and their effects on the community. Why don't I just give you time to say what you'd like about the effect of drugs on your community and approaches that you think are needed to deal with them?
Oh, well, thanks very much. First of all, I appreciate being here with Tom and being educated, so thanks for that. And I think generally I agree with what Tom has had to say. I think that certainly budgets require reprioritizing efforts, and I think we could all agree that they're really, in terms of what benefits society most, I don't think there's a tremendous amount of benefit to arresting people, incarcerating people for growing marijuana or using marijuana. You know, having said that, you know, I've said before, I think it should be legalized. I think it's something that we should look at seriously, not because I'm a marijuana user and not because I promote the use of marijuana. I think people shouldn't, but I think people should, you know, they need to make their own choices. The bigger issue for me, Carl, is that we have to make priorities. And the simple fact of the matter is we will always have more need than we have resources. And those resources, we're certainly seeing that now. Those resources are more and more precious. I also agree with what Tom had to say about it always seems to be one extreme or the other. We're going to talk about S-292 a little bit later in the program. And again, we're going to, you know, we're sort of watching the pendulum swing the other way, where we're not doing enough, in my opinion, to rehabilitate people. When Senator Leahy came to town, the bulk of my testimony, I'm fairly conservative. I have conservative views politically, but I'm more of a fiscal conservative. I mean, I believe in my heart of hearts, I believe that we are our brother's keeper. You know, I've been given a tremendous number of opportunities in my life and been able to take advantage of those. And I think that's the purpose of government, in my opinion. Government is there to present people with opportunities and give them an opportunity to better themselves. And I think we're focusing way too much on incarceration and punishment. You know, we love it. It makes us feel better. We get the revenge that we long for. Okay, so it makes us feel a little better, but it doesn't fix the problem. You know, in my opinion, I think we need to focus more on prevention, and we need to focus more on rehabilitation. When you talk about prevention, I don't think we're doing enough to identify young people at risk. And I think there are a number of identifying characteristics that can virtually predict, you know, children. Some of it's not fun to talk about because sometimes some folks might view it as socioeconomic stereotyping. But it's simple facts. You know, we don't make these things up. We can show you that a certain portion of the population, certain segment of the population, we can identify children who are at risk very young.
What do you look at to identify those children?
You know, socioeconomically, generally, people who are living well below the poverty standard will generally be more easily influenced and can turn to a life of crime. Doesn't mean that they do in every instance, but it certainly is a risk factor. But when you talk about that, people feel like you're stereotyping people, and you're not. You know, you're trying to identify them so that you can help them. You know, in my opinion, and I'm certainly not as educated as Tom here, you know, for the most part, I can do your taxes. But, but you know, what I've, you know, I think the best education I've had is from, you know, 18 years of raising, you know, Karen and I raising Alex and Miranda and going to school meetings and talking to other parents. You know, and it's just quite frankly amazing to me the number of parents who just don't parent. You know, when we started out in kindergarten, there would be 30 of us, 30 parents at the kindergarten meeting, you know, and they would have these parent meetings. And then as we got to be the first grade and then the third grade, and I can remember a sixth grade meeting where a teacher sent a note home and she said, we're starting this new mathematics program. It's going to be very challenging. We're going to need parental support to get the kids through it. So I'm having this very, very important meeting, and I'd like to encourage all of the parents to come. Karen and I went there. It was Karen and I and one other parent. Wow. And it was a class of 25.
Wow.
And you know, and I remember that to this day. And I think we need, that's what we need to work on as a society. You know, we need to work on, you know, and we all need help. You know, there are times where I've been a crappy parent at times. I mean, there are times where you look back and it's like, oh, man, I shouldn't have done that. You know, we've all been there. But fortunately, we were able to self-correct, or in my case, wife-correct. And she's real good at that. But you know, we need more support. I think families need more support. Because
I've heard,
you know,
also just eliminating poverty is a good way to eliminate these risks.
You know, and I think we're doing, you know, listen, like I said, we'll always have more problems when we have resources. But we need to, in my opinion, you know, we need to identify children at an earlier age who are at risk. And, you know, and sometimes if family intervention is required, I mean, maybe it should be a requirement, not always a choice. Maybe government should make an investment in families and say to a mom and dad who we can see are struggling, particularly raising their children, look, you know, we're going to intervene here. And, you know, and we're going to have a program for you, and we're going to work with your family so that we can help you raise your children. If it's help, you know, if it's help getting a job, you know, I think we need to do more in the prevention role.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got a caller whose name isn't Scott, isn't Tom. It's Scott from Northfield. Hello, Scott.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good,
great
thanks.
Topic. I'm glad to have been able to attend that summit the other day. Not that I found it very